and welcome back, Match Volume listeners. I hope you had a fun and restful Labor Day weekend. This week on the show, we have Tiffany Townend-Blacknell. Tiffany is a public defense lawyer in the LA Public Defender's Office and an advocate for criminal justice reform. Last week, I got the chance to talk to Tiffany about her career and her thoughts on today's criminal justice system.
My name is Tiffany Blacknell, Tiffany Townend-Blacknell. I am a deputy public defender for Los Angeles County, and I'm now the recruitment coordinator for the office.
Very cool. So you came and spoke at a pre-law event that I went to a couple years ago at USC, and I just was fascinated by your career. So why don't you start by talking about how you ended up where you are? Did you always wanted to go into law, or how did you decide to pursue this career?
I had a pretty interesting path, I think. I'm a first-generation college student and first-generation professional. I grew up in South LA, which is an environment at the time that was plagued by a lot of violence, gangs, drugs, poverty, untreated mental illness. And so I was adjacent to populations that I knew were suffering and that would have entered the system. And so that left an impression with me as a child growing up, seeing what I believe to be the injustices of the criminal system. And when I got to undergrad, I decided to go for it. I didn't know anything about law school or how to really navigate applications, the LSAT, et cetera, but I sort of just stepped out on faith essentially and applied to all the law schools in Los Angeles because I didn't want to move far from my family. And that's how I ended up at USC. At USC, I did have there was a moment where I had to decide if I were going to go towards my passion, which is criminal justice reform, or whether or not I was going to go towards big law, because I was a child of poverty and I really wanted to make money, right? But once I started law school, constitutional law, criminal law, I knew that was the space I felt most comfortable. And I did my first internship with the federal public defender in the Capitol Habeas Unit. I was intrigued by the Capitol Habeas Unit. They handled all the death penalty appeals in California. I was intrigued by their work, and I was very empathetic towards their clients, but it didn't feel fast-paced enough for me until I interned as a 2L in the LA County Public Defender's Office. And there I really felt like I was home. Sometimes law school can be a very difficult social experiment. And for me, I felt very different than my classmates. I didn't feel like I fit in. And then you kind of wonder if you don't fit in, whether or not law is for you, right? But then I got to the office, the LA County Public Defender's Office, and man, I felt like I'm home. Like these are my people, and not necessarily my people in terms of look like me or have my same life experience, but they were had a similar mission, and that is to help people who we believe to be suffering. And I felt like these people share a common character than me. And so I knew that I was there. And so after that, after I got to our office, I knew how my career would start. And I didn't worry the last 2 years about getting a job. I knew I was home.
So what does the day-to-day look like in your job? What do you do every day?
So as a trial lawyer, which I have been for 17 years. I recently transitioned into this position as a recruiter, but as a trial lawyer in felonies, for example, when it's different in different parts of the office, as a juvenile lawyer, a misdemeanor lawyer, a felony trial lawyer. So as a trial lawyer, you have your calendar every day. You have clients that are on calendar, and they could be on calendar for a myriad of reasons. It could be a bail hearing. So you're arguing to get someone out of custody. It could be for a preliminary hearing, which means you're cross-examining witnesses and asking the court to dismiss your client's case. It could be for a simple pretrial. So after I look at my calendar, I get my file folders, I go down to court, and I go to all the courts where I'm assigned to be to hear a matter. And that usually takes a couple of hours. So I'm usually done in a felony rotation in the morning, 11 o'clock at the latest. So I talk to my client before and after every appearance. I have conversations with the people who love them, their family and friends in the audience, talk to the DA about whatever we're doing that day, either witnesses or missing discovery, evidence that they haven't turned over yet. And then we call the case. And after all that's happened on each case, maybe four or five cases in a felony, average felony rotation, you go up to your office and then you work on the cases. And that could mean you write investigation requests, That could mean you write requests for the DA to give you evidence, motions to dismiss the case, research, legal research and writing. You meet with investigators about your case. You meet with experts. And you do that for all the cases that you have. So you just work the rest of the day, typically, with preparing for the next day, for the next week, for the next case. And we are, except when you're in trial. When you're in a trial, typically you have people who, fellow public defenders who will stand in for you for the morning matters, and you only do the trial all day. And that could be jury selection or arguing evidence or cross-examining witnesses. And so those tend to last the entire day, maybe 10 to 12 and then 1:30 all the way to 4:30.
So is it ever challenging to work on cases that you're really passionate about? Do you have to kind of go into a separate mode when you're in the office and kind of separate yourself from these cases?
You know, I wish I could. I mean, if I were better at this, if I were better at self-care and at boundaries, I would be able to just work on the case and be sort of not robotic, but compartmentalize things. Unfortunately, because of my life experience, I'm sort of adjacent to the community that I serve, and I feel things on a deeper level. And that can be very difficult, but it's also extraordinarily rewarding to be able to step in that space, to tell my clients' stories, to people, commonly jurors and judges, who don't really know the life experience that I have. And so when I'm able to sort of be a voice for someone who is, you know, system impacted, who is facing prison, who is away from their family and loved ones, it's a powerful moment. And me identifying with them actually makes it more rewarding. On the flip side, when you lose, it makes it more devastating, because you think about it in terms of how it affects that person's family, how it affects the people that they love, how their lives are cut short, the things they won't be able to do. And it can be difficult. So now, as a recruiter, when I do the trainings for the new law clerks and new lawyers, I talk about self-care. I talk about trying to develop something that you can do that restores you when you have those big losses, because you'll need something to balance you out. You'll need something that will kind of feed you when you're kind of at your lowest point. And I've learned how to do that over almost an 18-year career.
Was there a case towards the beginning of your career where you realized you were like, wow, this is really important work that I'm doing?
You know, in our office, you start off in preliminary hearings. You're basically standing in for a lawyer and being trained on how to cross-examine witnesses and question witnesses and make arguments. And then you get your first very own client when you're in misdemeanors. So for me, it happens in every stage of the process. So as a brand new lawyer, my very first case, my very first hearing was a preliminary hearing. And the lady was a little old Black lady in downtown LA who was caught with 5 little bundles of crack cocaine. And the officers who arrested her didn't arrest her as a person who personally possessed narcotics, which could have given her access to treatment. They charged her as a seller. And I knew in my heart that she was not a seller. She looked to be homeless. She looked to be unwealthy, poor dental care. I mean, all the earmarks of homelessness that you see, she exhibited. And so I believed her. I believed that she was only possessing the rock cocaine for her own use and not to sell. And so I'm in this hearing, and these hearings, the older lawyers will tell you, you're not supposed to win. Like the judges are gonna tell you no, so just do your best, but don't get your heart broken. And in this hearing, I'm arguing with this judge, and I'm objection. And I'm just like, just tenacious and persistent, which I am to this day. And the judge, of course, said denied and refused to dismiss the case. But my client leaned over and said, thank you for fighting for me. And for me, even in defeat, that felt like a victory, because she saw that someone cared. And we can't always win every case. Obviously, as public defenders, we don't. But we can always demand, you can always show up, right? You can always show up for your client. And oftentimes our clients have had such difficult lives that you're the only person that's fought for them in a very long time. And so you get to give that to someone and to make the system acknowledge their dignity, which is something that they don't teach you in law school, and that you don't get to do in almost any other profession, is get to like make the system stop and look at your client like a human being and not like an animal or a number, a case number. So I think I got it my first day on the record, which is probably a week after I got hired. And then I saw it again as an as I got a little bit older, in my later 20s, I was very young when I started the office, and juvenile, because now you're an adult defending a child. And you really see, as I got older, how small they are. You know, you hear about a crime, a horrific crime committed by a juvenile. Only when you look in their eyes and see their baby faces with no hair. And I had a client who was 11, whose feet didn't touch the ground. He was that small in stature, that you really think, you really appreciate the magnitude of your work, because your advocacy could change the course of this young person's life. And so I really felt the weight of that. The weight of defending children in this criminal system is tremendous. And I took it very seriously. And so I would, like, you know, visit my clients all the time and talk to them about TV shows and just keep them company, because they're away from their families for so long. Oftentimes you're the only kind face they see. And so, yeah, I felt the magnitude of that. And then again, on my first homicide case, where you're looking at crime scene photos of a person who's lost their life. And that's incredibly sad. And it taught me a little bit something different about victims of crime and how much they suffer. And I have lost someone in my life to violent crime as well. And so I had a lot of empathy for victims who are in court, who are waiting to see the person who took someone from them. And so it became even more, I guess, weightier after seeing someone who's lost their life to violent crime. Or it became weightier recently, a year or so ago, when I was promoted to become a capital lawyer. So now my job is to defend those who are facing the death penalty. And there can be no greater weight than actually being responsible for someone's life, a 19-year-old's life. And so it grows, you know, it grows, and you see how the system impacts human beings and their communities. And so it's changed over my career, but the weight is always there, and the importance of what we do is always present. People think about wrongful convictions, right? When I was in law school, that was kind of cutting edge of, like, DNA, in the very first Innocent Project back in 2000 or so. And I remember reading those books. I remember meeting Barry Scheck, who kind of championed this DNA revolution, and him discussing wrongful convictions. And now there's been hundreds or thousands, right, of people who have been exonerated. And people think to themselves about the conditions of prison, they think, well, the bad people go there, the child molesters go there, the rapists go there, the murderers go there, so we don't care what happens to them. But what they're neglecting to think about are the people who could be innocent, who are there, or the people who are addicted, who are there, or the people who are mentally ill, who are there. And they're also tortured, and they're also victims of violent crime. And so when we legitimize that environment of prison, you know, we're not thinking about the people who are lost within it, who could be innocent, but are still suffering. And so I think that's, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard as society, that we have a place where we send people that is humane and not barbaric.
I think with the Black Lives Matter movement coming again to, like, kind of the forefront, it's encouraging some much needed change with that, with criminal justice reform. Have you seen that impact your work at all? Or is that still kind of needed?
You know, I think that it's bringing awareness. I think that in the past, society, especially folks who haven't really been in communities where you're over-policed, right. I think that it was sort of eye-opening. Like, oh God, look, we're watching a video and someone's dying, and why is he dying? What is happening? And so I think that it brought awareness to people, and in that way, it helps, because oftentimes in our cases, you have an officer saying the client did something wrong. You have our client saying no, but your client's a gang member, your client's a drug addict, your client has a bunch of felony convictions. So they're not going to believe your client. They're going to think the police officer is honest, telling the truth. But all this awareness around, you know, police practices has, I think, brought some more realism to the jury pool. Now the jury is no longer, the idea of an officer lying is not a foreign concept anymore.
Right. Right.
It's normal. It's really brought it to the mainstream for people who had not witnessed that. But for me, you know, my first time I was ever pulled over by police at gunpoint, I was 12 years old. Wow. In the car with my sister, who was 16. And so I know that experience very well, that fear of being in an officer's crosshairs, and what that does to children. And you grow up sort of expecting them to do harm in a way that many children don't have that life experience. So, you know, it was triggering for me, to be honest, but it was not a surprise.
I also wanted to ask you about COVID and how that's affected things with your work, as like our trials on Zoom. What does life in prison look like now?
So in LA County specifically, they have paused trials. I believe they're to resume the week after next, I believe, September 13th. In fact, actually, they're doing a test run this week on a trial to see how that we can best make the environment as safe as possible. In terms of prison, you know, there was an outbreak in many prisons in California. Dozens of people have died and lost their lives who were incarcerated. Locally, there was a rush initially to get people out of jail. So LA County has the largest jail system on earth, the largest by far. 17,000 people were in local jails in LA County.
Wow.
And they reduced it to 12. There was no crime spike, by the way, but they reduced it to 12 to make room for some semblance of social distancing. But it really doesn't exist in custody because of the nature of jail. What we saw happening, many people don't know this, but people who are incarcerated often do all the work. They do the cleaning, they do the cooking, they pass out the meals to people. And so during a quarantine, at one point, so many different areas were quarantined that they were not allowed to work. And so our clients were eating rotten fruit, eating old stale sandwiches, and they could not get the food to them, or they did not create a system to get them the food that they needed. So that was a horrific byproduct. And we've lost a public defender. One of our public defenders, Sal Salgado, died of COVID. He was an active working public defender who was infected with disease, and he passed away, and that was horrible and frightening for all of us. Because at one point during the height of COVID, you know, it was the nursing homes and the prisons were the highest risk population, and they still are. And so they didn't do enough to stop the spread initially. And so it's basically a free for all. You know, any given day, if I have a court appearance on the cases that I still have, they'll tell me he's quarantined, he can't come to court. So they miss court dates. And many people have been waiting since March for their trial, who would have gone to trial. Now the California Supreme Court stopped trials in LA County until next week. But the one trial that is happening, they are crafting it so they only voir dire 14 jurors at a time, which is typically they have, like, if it's a case like one of mine, a serious case, it would be 100 jurors in the audience. Now they're just 14, which makes things go a lot slower. They have plexiglass between us and our clients. They have everyone's masked, of course. They have gloves when you touch exhibits so that you don't spread whatever. They have glass around the witness booth. And they don't allow many people in court during the trial. So no detectives unless they're testifying.
I think part of being a public defender is building that trust with your client and letting them know that you're going to defend them. And I think with those separations, it can be really hard to build trust. So I am also curious about how that's going to go.
It's hard to communicate in the moment because you really can't lean over, right? That's the social distancing piece. Right. And they can sometimes write out notes and slide it to you, but that's, you know, sometimes not as efficient as you would like it to be.
Right.
You know, I think our clients understand that we are doing the best we can to get them out as soon as possible. And many people have been released, but it's still very frustrating for them that they don't have the right to go into trial as they would have before COVID in a faster manner. And that they're afraid that jurors won't show up, right? That jurors are too afraid to be in that space all day long. Mm-hmm. And so maybe they won't show up, or they're afraid that we'll be too distracted by being worried about catching COVID that we won't do our best work.
Right.
It's just a challenge all across the board, and there are no easy answers to it.
Yeah.
But I wish at least the jail would test our clients before they brought them to court, and they bring them out into a space with a bunch of the public. And I think it's reckless, careless.
It is.
It's tough. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are so many people who are in prison for nonviolent crimes.
Yes.
That they could easily put a huge dent in this if they were just to release them. Are people who had less than 18 months to go or 2 years to go in their sentence, that they're going home anyway, right? No one's saying Charles Manson gets to get out because of COVID. It's like the people who are in there for drug offenses or for nonviolent crimes or for low to your crimes.
Right.
They could be released and it could do a huge service, because literally California has lost 5 of its death row inmates to COVID, more than we've actually executed in 40 years.
Wow. Wow.
Or at least the last 20 years.
Yeah.
They've done 13 since the 70s.
Do you ever have moral conflicts with your cases? Like, if you know someone is guilty and but you still have to defend them, is that challenging to do?
You know, in that way, that has rarely ever crossed my mind, to be honest, because I believe if I know that they're guilty, then the state has enough evidence to prove it as well.
Right.
And at that point, I'm mitigating the harm. And so even if someone's guilty of a crime, I don't believe that people should be put to death. So I have no quarrel morally with advocating for their life. Or if someone committed a horrible crime, I don't believe they should go to prison for 50 years, right? And so that to me alleviates the moral question. If I thought prison was a place where people would actually be bettered, like if they would be educated, if they would be treated for their mental health issues or treated for their trauma that they experience or in some way improved, I wouldn't be so opposed to it. Mm-hmm. But as it is now, I think people go in there and they come out more violent than they were when they went in, and no one protects them from that. And so I don't want to perpetuate that system of sending people to places that just harm.
Right.
And I want to work more towards prevention, crime prevention, than on crime punishment.
Yeah.
But it's a rare occasion where I say, oh, I'm sure he did it, you know. But mostly public defenders, all criminal defense attorneys, most criminal cases are pled, right? There's not that many that go to trial. But chances are, if your client is in front of a jury, it's because they really didn't do it,
mm-hmm.
because they're offering him a life sentence and he doesn't want to accept it. Those are the two most often tried cases. But if the system works, if the system does its job, then people who are guilty will be convicted. And mm-hmm. So my job is then to defend the Constitution, to ensure that their Fourth Amendment right to be free from search and seizure illegally is honored, that their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is honored, that their right, Sixth Amendment right to counsel is honored. And that's what I'm in the business of, is of making the state honor my client's constitutional rights.
Right.
And some of us look at it that way. We have to have a system that works for everyone.
Right.
That is the same, because there how many hundreds of men have been found guilty by juries and they weren't?
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
These people listened to the evidence, they heard the arguments, and they somehow all 12 came back with unanimous verdict for guilty, and oftentimes the death penalty. So you have to think that person who was charged, who was wrongfully convicted, like Ronald Cotton, for example, of a horrible rape that he didn't commit, that everyone in the world thought he was guilty, but he was not. And so you have to kind of be careful about the guilty versus the innocent, because who knows at this point, mm-hmm. the way, because oftentimes when people are wrongfully convicted, it's because they looked guilty and everyone believed it, because they had a bad record, because they were drug addicts, because they were unintelligent or whatever. And so those are the people who need the most protection, to be honest, to make sure that it's really what it seems. But the biggest part, and what I want your audience to know, is this. I read somewhere recently that 80% of people in the country hate their jobs, right? And when you are at work most of your day, literally, you're at work 9-10 hours a day, oftentimes, and you don't ever want to choose a profession that you don't love. Even if it's difficult, even if it's not as popular, even if it's not as lucrative, you should always be pulled towards what's calling you. And oftentimes we get distracted by money and our parents and their expectations. But you should really follow your passion, because I'm telling you, my life is virtually perfect between my amazing family and children and a career that I love. You cannot get a better life than that. And every day I know, not only will I enjoy litigation, which I do, find it intellectually challenging, I get to spar with people in court, but I get to help people. And that's pretty rare, that you get to love what you do and that you get to help people who are less fortunate than you are. And every now and again, the heavens open up and we get to save a life. Mm-hmm. And because of you, a life has been set free. And that is what I want students to actually go towards. Go toward what makes your heart happy. and that you'll never work a day in your life if you really move towards the thing that pulls you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Tiffany.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Thanks for listening. Tune in every Monday for new episodes of Match Volume.